This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, sports gambling is rising in more and more states. That means a greater risk for problem gambling and addiction. We'll learn more about the warning signs and how to help someone you might be concerned about. Now we look back at what led up to the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor 81 years ago today. Here's President Franklin D. Roosevelt speaking to Congress in the aftermath of the attack.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific.
We're going to dig into that conversation and that diplomatic history today and learn about a figure at the center of the story, the U.S. ambassador in Tokyo at the time of the attack. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what led up to the Pearl Harbor attack? What do you remember hearing about it at the time, if you were around with us then, or from your parents or your grandparents? What questions do you have on this anniversary? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Steve Kemper is a journalist and author of several books. His latest is called Our Man in Tokyo, An American Ambassador and the Countdown to Pearl Harbor. Steve, welcome to Central Time. Do we have you there? There we do. Steve, let's start with the ambassador at the center of your story before he gets to this very difficult situation in Japan. Can you tell us a little bit about the career of Joseph Clark Grew?
Sure. He was born to Boston Brahmins, grew up on Beacon Hill, went to prep school at Groton, and then followed his father and brothers to Harvard. That was where the Grews went. And when he got out of Harvard, he was expected to go into Boston business or banking. He had no interest in those things at all. So eventually he ended up going into the State Department instead of going onto State Street. He served in 14 posts during his career. He was more or less a legend in the State Department because of his accomplishments and his post and what he had done. And that's why in 1932, when the Japanese invaded Manchuria, President Herbert Hoover decided to send our best man to the most difficult mission in the world at the time, Japan.
And let's talk about what he's walking into in Japan. This is amazing. He gets word. He's going to be the ambassador to Japan. He's on his way, you know, I think taking the train across the country to take a ship over to Japan. When news breaks, the Japanese prime minister assassinated by radical far-right members of the Japanese military. What was he in for with this appointment?
a roller coaster ride. He called it actually like he was living on a volcano. Japan was a mess. Before I started researching this book, I didn't have much idea about it. And we all know about the 30s in Europe, Germany and Italy and so on. But this was a mystery to me, and it was fascinating. It was complete chaos over there. This wasn't the first assassination, or would it be the last? It was the second prime minister assassinated within 18 months. There were plots, conspiracies. There were internecine wars within the right wing of some people were not right wing enough for other right wingers. There were patriotic societies that they called themselves patriotic societies that were essentially right wing groups that were intent upon overthrowing any cabinet that wanted to have closer relations with the Western nations. So Grew had a handful.
Oh, the amazing thing is reading your book, and I didn't really realize this so much. The first question is, who am I the ambassador to? Because you had the emperor, right, who is the ultimate, you know, acknowledged leader, almost a cult-like devotion to the emperor of Japan, and actually has no practical power to do anything. There's what looks like a civilian government with a prime minister and a cabinet and a parliament sort of thing, except they don't control the army and navy, which are sort of under the emperor, and they sort of appoint their own leaders without any input from the prime minister. There's a question as to who actually has the power to make any significant decision.
You've got that exactly right. That was Gru's dilemma. An ambassador has to figure out where are the levers of power and influence. And in most countries, it's pretty easy. It's the despot, or it's the political leaders, or it's clear. In Japan, there were all these little centers of power, and they were all competing: the palace advisors, the emperor, the military, and the branches of the military were competing with each other. Then you had the, as you said, the cabinet, and then you had the parliament, or Diet, as it was called there. So, and then all these right-wing patriotic societies also had quite a say in how people were feeling about things. So Gru did his best, and but it was a maze. It was kind of chaotic.
We're talking to Steve Kemper about his new book, Our Man in Tokyo, an American ambassador and the countdown to Pearl Harbor, focused on the ambassador Joseph Clark Grew in the run-up to war between Japan and the United States. If you have questions about that era, the lead-up to that war and to Pearl Harbor, which we commemorate today, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. A big question here is, of course, I think, was war with Japan, or from Japan's perspective, was war with the United States inevitable? How did Joseph Clark Grew try to figure out as he navigated this complex situation?
Well, an ambassador's primary task is to maintain peace between his country and the host country. And that's what Grew put all of his energies into right up to the very end. And I mean the very end, the night before Pearl Harbor happened. He was still working for peace. So he spent 10 years trying to do it. Whether the question you asked at the beginning, was war inevitable, is that's the $100,000 question, of course. Grew, he believed up to the end that it was not inevitable. But looking back on it now, it appears that there was nothing he could do to stop this wave of fanaticism. This group of right wingers was determined to expand the imperial empire. Their egomania and their quest for power was immense, and Gru did everything he could to stop it. And it looked like a few times there might have been a chance to avert it or to postpone it, but they were always overwhelmed in the end by the right-wing passion for expansion.
Now, of course, Gru, as ambassador, is navigating this tough situation in Japan. He's also looking over his shoulder at the State Department and the President and Washington, and sometimes frustrated by the messages he was getting from back home and that the Japanese public and leadership was getting from the United States. What kind of things did he see as making his job more difficult?
Well, if you want to talk about the State Department, he was a good soldier in his own self-description. So, and his job as an ambassador is to convey the policies of his country to the host government. He always did that. Behind the scenes, however, in his letters, in his diary, he was sometimes frustrated, as you said, because primarily because the U.S., in particular, Secretary of State Cordell Hull, could be intransigent. His standards were so high, his ideals were so high that they made him inflexible sometimes. Whereas Gru, as a diplomat, is working on the art of compromise, and that means being flexible. So sometimes Gru's personal opinion.
Now, from time to time, Gru is warning, hey, war is definitely a possibility with Japan. But he's also encouraging, I think, if I'm reading you right, the American government not to do too much saber rattling and to be willing to negotiate and compromise. Can you talk about how he tried to thread that needle?
Oh boy, that's a really good question. He tried to thread it by knowing what the pressure points were on both sides. An ambassador sort of in the middle. He's working in two directions, towards his government, towards the host government. So he's trying to gather information from both sides and then use that to figure out where is my path. And he tried to do that with the Japanese in several ways. He kept things behind the scenes. That's sort of the definition of diplomacy, at least from Gru, by telling them you need to stop doing some of the things you're doing, such as bombing American properties in Japan, taking over property. You need to stop doing that. You keep promising you will and you don't. And if you don't stop, the American public is going to get angry. You think that they're a bunch of isolationists and pacifists who won't go to war, but I'm telling you, the sheepskin will come off and the land will come roaring out and you'll be sorry. On the Japan side, on the American side, he was telling Hull, these people are fanatical and they are capable of sudden dramatic actions, and we need to try to figure out a way for them to save face, to be able to back off of some of the things they're doing so that we can find a path towards peace.
We're talking to author Steve Kemper about his new book, Our Man in Tokyo, an American ambassador and the countdown to Pearl Harbor. Today is Pearl Harbor Day, commemorating the 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor. This ambassador in Tokyo at the center of the story. You can join in with your questions for our guest about his research, his work on the run-up to World War II, U.S. involvement in World War II. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with journalist and author Steve Kemper on the anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. We're talking about his new book. It's called Our Man in Tokyo, an American ambassador and the countdown to Pearl Harbor, centering around that ambassador, Joseph Clark Grew, his efforts to prevent World War II, or at least American involvement in it, a war with Japan in the Pacific. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller. Michael is with us in Mequon. Michael, hi.
Hi, thanks for the call. Very interesting topic. My understanding is that there was a document called the Tanaka Memorial that may have been published around 1928. That outlined the idea that Japan was destined to be the superior power in the Pacific, and that the U.S. was the primary blockage to attaining that goal. I've read that some historians have thought that that was a fictitious document, that it was written by perhaps British intelligence to help drive the U.S. In a direction against Japan. Do you have any insights into whether the Tanaka Memorial was real and did it have a significant effect on Japanese strategy?
Interesting question, Michael. Steve, there is a lot of historical controversy about this thing.
Well, I don't know much about that particular document, but I can tell you that the contents, as you describe them, were not made up by British intelligence. Those were just the facts as the Japanese believed them. They did think that they were destined for imperial glory in the Far East. They thought that they were destined to rule the Far East. They were the superior race in Asia, as Germany felt they were the superior race in Europe. They felt that the United States was the principal obstacle to that goal because Britain was on one knee in the war. France had been defeated. The Netherlands had been defeated. The only things standing between them and taking over was, what is the United States going to do? And so that document is, maybe it's part of some conspiracy by some people, but I know for a fact that that's what was believed by most of the people in Japan.
Michael, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Your book covers really a 10-year period when Drew becomes the ambassador to Japan up through Pearl Harbor. Let's move in a little closer. Now, November 3rd, 1941, about a month before the Pearl Harbor attack, Drew in a dispatch includes the line, "Armed conflict with the United States might come with dangerous and dramatic suddenness." Can you talk about that last month of scramble to prevent that armed conflict?
Well, this is interesting because there's sort of two streams going into it. There's what Grew sensed and knew from being in Japan, and his information, his informants, many of them had dried up because it had become very dangerous to come to the embassy. It had become very dangerous even to speak English on the streets or anywhere else. But he sensed what was happening because of the contacts that he had, which were still strong, to the cabinet and the palace. On the other side, you had this program called MAGIC. We had decrypted the diplomatic traffic, Japan's diplomatic code, so that FDR and Hull knew exactly what was going back and forth between Tokyo and Washington, Tokyo and Berlin. They knew what the Japanese were planning, and that was also two-pronged. On the one hand, they were continuing to negotiate, and on the other side, they made clear they were planning for war, and both those things were in the diplomatic cables that Hull and FDR were reading. So as we got about the early November, the date had been set, and there wasn't much that anybody could do. They had agreed, the military had agreed that if by some miracle the United States will give us everything that we want, then we're not going to attack. But meanwhile, you diplomats keep talking. And they started to move troops, and we were aware of that troop movement. But of course, it's not like today. We just had sporadic reports about it. We didn't have any good, hard information about it. So that on the night before Pearl Harbor, for instance, FDR sent a cable directly to Hirohito through GRU. He was instructed GRU to deliver it, saying, we are the leaders of our nations. It looks like your nation is heading towards a plan for war. I hope that we as the leaders can stop this, because it would be terrible for both of our countries. And GRU delivered that at midnight to the foreign minister the night before Pearl Harbor. The foreign minister knew it was too late. He knew that you know, this was a dead letter, essentially. He took that cable, and he said he would deliver it. The next morning, GRU got up, and he had a message to come see the foreign minister right away. So he dressed, went over there. The foreign minister handed him some papers saying we're breaking off negotiations. That's all he said. And GRU thought, being the optimist that he was, well, I'll work on this in a few days. He went home, put on his golfing togs to go play golf, and then you heard the newsboys in the street crying, war is declared. Japan has bombed Pearl Harbor. So that's how GRU found out about it. It was a very intense few weeks beforehand. And I'm leaving a lot out, of course, condensing a lot here.
Sure. We are talking about the career of American Ambassador Joseph Clark GRU. Our guest is Steve Kemper, author of the book Our Man in Tokyo, An American Ambassador and the Countdown to Pearl Harbor, on this, the anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attack. Let's bring on another caller now. Brad is with us in McHenry, Illinois. Brad, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up?
Well, I was curious. He brought up the primary, basically the primary duty of any ambassador is to keep peace with the nation that they're assigned to as ambassador. So if he had been successful in his duties and Japan had never attacked Pearl Harbor, what may have brought the United States into war with Japan, you know, aside from that, and where would we be today? Where would China be, who, you know, Japan had invaded and was, you know, to my knowledge, faring fairly poorly against them, you know, before the United States got involved and took a lot of Japan's war resources.
Brad, I gotcha. Thanks for the question, Steve. I don't know if we can get up to the present day, but absent that attack, I mean, a lot of people viewed on both sides the situation in the Pacific and the, you know, Japanese occupation of much of China and elsewhere as an unacceptable state of affairs. Putting off the Pearl Harbor attack, would it have really guaranteed peace for that much longer?
I doubt it. It's one of those hypotheticals that you never know. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned before, Japan seemed determined to expand. The United States was determined that that would not happen, at least not without limits. The United States had been very patient and had tried many, many different avenues to shore up or maintain or, you know, challenge Japan to stop in order before things got out of hand. Nothing worked. Nothing. Nothing from Washington. Nothing from GRU. So I don't know. I'm afraid it seems kind of inevitable.
Thanks for that question. I want to talk a little bit about the aftermath for Ambassador GRU and his staff. Japan bombs Pearl Harbor. In effect, GRU and the American embassy are almost prisoners as much as they are diplomats at that point. Can you talk about the journey from the Pearl Harbor attack to them returning to New York?
Sure. Of course, after Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, they weren't Gru and his staff were actually no longer diplomats. They had no contact with the Japanese government. They were just interned. They were prisoners of war inside the embassy. That lasted for 6 months as both sides negotiated the release of their respective diplomatic corps. In that 6 months, Gru wrote what he called his final report from Japan, which he was his analysis of what had happened and why. It was 277 pages long or something like that. When he got back to the U.S., he gave it to Secretary of Hull straight away, and with the gist of it, Hull looked through it and threw it back across the desk at Gru and told him to destroy every copy he had of it. So Gru did put it in his papers at Harvard, but he noted that 133 pages had been eliminated. And he also left in, though, a cover letter that he had written while he was on the ship coming back, a cover letter to FDR, 13 pages. And that's still in the archive. And when he refers in that letter to his final report, there's a Gru's little handwritten note saying, "Destroyed at Mr. Hull's request," which when you're a researcher, that's an exquisite little find, because it's Gru saying there was a crime committed here and I'm not going to cover it up.
And it's got to be tantalizing and frustrating for you as a researcher, knowing that it existed at one point and probably doesn't.
Well, that's sort of the takeoff point of my book, because the issue is Gru wanted to know, could we have done anything different? That was Gru's pressing question for himself and for his government. And so it became mine for my book. And you can find Gru's answer to it in all of his letters. He wrote so many letters, 6,000 pages of his diary just in Tokyo, and all of his dispatches back and forth. So if you dig through everything, you begin to get a sense like something arising out of the stone. There is an image that comes to the surface.
Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
That's Steve Kemper. We talked to him about his new book, Our Man in Tokyo, An American Ambassador and the Countdown to Pearl Harbor, on this, the anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attacks. Coming up tomorrow on the morning show, if I get a firsthand perspective on toy stores in the Christmas season, that's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, we talked about children's games, songs, and customs that make up what's called child lore, things that kids learn from other kids and pass them on. A lot of you shared your memories on the air and on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Here's one more on Facebook. Danny tells us, "We played a game when I was a kid called Ghost in the Graveyard. It was a combination of tag and hide and seek. One person played the ghost, counted to 10. The others had to hide. Once the person who was seeking the people who hid found one, that person would shout out, 'Ghost in the Graveyard,' and everyone had to run to a safe place. Now the person who was the ghost is supposed to tag one of those people before they make it to the safe place. They become the ghost, and it starts all over again." Danny says, "My daughter taught this to my grandson. My grandson took it to Cub Scout camp, taught all of his friends at Cub Scouts, and they were playing it all night long into the evening." Thanks, Danny. I played that game. We didn't call it Ghost in the Graveyard, just like a version of tag, I guess. You can keep sharing your memories on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, an epidemiologist shares what she's doing this holiday season to protect vulnerable loved ones from flu, RSV, and COVID. Now, it seems like you can't get through a live broadcast of a sporting event these days without seeing or hearing some kind of advertisement for sports betting, like these.
It's easy. All you have to do is download it, make a deposit, pick a sport, place a bet. Boom, goes the dynamite. Out comes the cash. Simple.
The buzzer beaters, the walk-off blast, and every Hail Mary pass is one tap away from you doing your victory dance.
Now you're in the ring with the king of sportsbooks.
And that's how you do more than just bet. That's how you live your bet life.
In Wisconsin, you can legally bet on sporting events if you go in person to one of a few select tribal casinos. But all you have to do is step across the state line into, say, Illinois, Iowa, or Michigan. Your cell phone turns into a full-service sports book in your pocket. That comes after the U.S. Supreme Court ended a federal ban on online betting a few years ago, leaving it up to states. For some gamblers, sports betting can become a powerful addiction that has severe consequences in their lives. Our next guest says it's important to know the warning signs of problem sports gambling and the resources available to help. Mary Drexler is the director of the Maryland Center of Excellence on Problem Gambling at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. She wrote a recent column in the Washington Post sharing advice to keep online sports gambling under control. Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob, for having me.
Can you talk about the game changer, the availability of online sports betting in so much of the country now? How has that affected the amount people gamble and the risk of addiction?
Yeah, well, I think as it rolls out, and you know it's been rolling out nationally, there's greater opportunity, convenience to bet, especially with sports. Individuals think, you know, I know my favorite team, so I'm going to know how to bet that they have an edge on it. And people need to be careful about that. And it poses even bigger risks, risks to one's mental health, not just the financial risks that are involved there. You know, a lot of people, the adverse consequences with online sports betting, which it does appear that individuals will make bigger bets or more bets and thus end up with bigger losses compared to with in-person bettors. You can do it from your living room couch all the way through the game. We're not just betting on who wins right now or who loses. We're betting on plays within the game. So some of these consequences can be anxiety, depression. You're not focusing on work anymore. You're starting to have financial problems and strained relationships.
How do we know when, you know, maybe harmless sort of gambling, whether it's going to a casino for sports betting or online or a fantasy pool with friends, say, is turning into a problem?
Well, I think one of the things is, are you preoccupied with your gambling? Are you thinking about it all day? Can't wait to place bets online? Constantly planning gambling activities, being focused on getting more money to gamble. These are all signs that could have a negative impact on your daily life. Also, do you have some withdrawal symptoms? A lot of gamblers will say they tried to stop or cut back, but couldn't do it. And some of these symptoms could be emotional, irritable, depressed. You even get physical symptoms, sweating, headaches, tension. Another one might be, are you hiding that activity? Gamblers are very good at hiding their gambling activity. So, you know, they lose money. They end up trying to borrow more money, but they cover everything with lies. And these lies have destroyed many of the relationships a gambler may have with their family and friends. And then this family member also is having to deal with the consequences of the behavior of the gambler. They'll even hide, they'll run to the mailbox to get the bills or the bank statements so a family member doesn't know what's happening.
It's easy to look in from the outside and say, well, just stop if it's a problem. I'm guessing, as with any kind of a compulsive or addictive behavior, that's easier said than done. What does it take to break a serious gambling addiction like this?
Well, I think first and foremost, the person needs to seek out help. There is help in all the states that have legalized gambling in those states. And there is the National Helpline for problem gambling. Right now it's 1-800-522-4700, and that's the National Council on Problem Gambling. Here in Maryland, our helpline number is 1-800-GAMBLER, and you can text or chat because that is the way of the world now. More people aren't making calls, but they're texting or chatting for help. Maryland is one of the states across this country that has no-cost treatment. So if you are a gambler with a problem, you can actually see a counselor at no cost to you, regardless of your income or insurance. And that in Maryland, you can also get that treatment as a family member because you're impacted by the gambling behavior. I am very happy here, and I think some other states have it as well. We have peer recovery support specialists who are on staff at the Maryland Center of Excellence on Problem Gambling. These are individuals with lived experience. Sometimes the gambler doesn't really want to go directly into counseling, but wants to talk to someone who's been there and has made it through and is in recovery. So those are some of the recommendations, but you have to connect with people. You need to talk about it.
Now, suppose we're seeing this in a family member, a loved one or a close friend, mm-hmm. say, are there ways to intervene, to help?
Yes, there are support groups for family members. Gammonon is one, which is national. Many states have Gammonon, and those are for the family members of a person who has a gambling problem. That's probably the primary, but they can call helplines across the different states. They can also provide them with some counseling alternatives, because sometimes the gambler is not ready to get the help does not mean that the family member should not seek out that help.
Do you have concerns about how this new wave of sports betting is being online sports betting is being marketed and maybe finding its way to audiences that it shouldn't?
Yeah, well, we know that it is a younger demographic typically with sports betting, that 18 to 24. But, you know, we also know that between 11 and 18 years old, young adult males are gambling. And the younger you start your gambling behavior, the more apt you are to have a gambling problem as you get older. So, the target population is definitely there on college campuses. We're already starting to hear on our helpline some college students who've lost their money, maxed out their credit cards, thinking they were going to get that big win and just got drawn into the ease of being able to bet online.
Mary, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
I thank you.
That's Mary Drexler, director of the Maryland Center of Excellence on Problem Gambling at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, with us today to share warning signs of sports gambling addictions, how we can help loved ones who might be struggling with it, with the rise of online sports gambling in many states around the country, not Wisconsin, at least not yet. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story from the world of music.
Imagine making it as a musician not only once, but at two distinct moments in your life. That's what happened to jazz saxophonist Frank Morgan of Milwaukee. Author Dean Robbins brings us the story on the musician's rebirth and stardom.
Frank Morgan grew up in Milwaukee, playing jazz guitar at an early age. But in 1940, his father took 7-year-old Frank to see a concert by alto saxophonist Charlie Parker. The experience changed his life. The minute Morgan heard Parker's starkly beautiful sound, he knew that alto sax was his destiny. He and his father went backstage to meet the genius who'd helped create the modern jazz style called bebop. With typical generosity, Parker took an interest in the boy and got him started on a reed instrument. Morgan became his protege, copying the master's jagged melodies and quicksilver rhythms. At 14, Frank was sitting in with top jazz players in Los Angeles. And at 22, when he released his debut album, word spread that Frank Morgan might become the next Charlie Parker. But it didn't happen. In the mid-1950s, Morgan succumbed to drug addiction, just as Parker had. His heroin habit led to a life of crime, and he spent most of the next 30 years behind bars. Instead of becoming a jazz celebrity, he performed for fellow inmates in the San Quentin prison band. Here he is on WHYY's Fresh Air in 1987.
In prison, the instrument was the thing that kept me sane, if you will. And the chance to play it, you know, kept me with hope.
After his release in 1985, Morgan finally recorded a second album, drawing on decades of pent-up emotion. Since prison had isolated him from a generation's worth of musical changes, listeners got the impression that a pure 1950s bebop pioneer had been magically transplanted to the 1980s. Morgan's resurrection fascinated the public, and his friendly smile began beaming out of magazines and TV screens. Audiences were touched by his sublime improvisations. He expressed gratitude for his long-delayed fame and committed himself to earning people's respect.
I really intend to play, and to play my heart out.
That meant staying off drugs, of course, which required extraordinary effort. To avoid temptation, Morgan threw himself into practicing and recording. He also moved back to Milwaukee in 1994 to be with supportive family members. I had a chance to interview Morgan after his return to Wisconsin, a state he dubbed pretty hip. He credited Milwaukee with giving him a great start in music, and the city's schools with providing an excellent education. and he was overwhelmed by the warm welcome he received from local jazz fans. I was one of those fans. I saw Morgan play a spectacular concert in Madison and continued to follow his career until he died from cancer in 2007 at age 73. His final years are one of the greatest second acts in jazz history, and his recordings endure as a testament to redemption and rebirth. Here he is on NPR's Piano Jazz.
Well, it's great to be alive, you know. Every day is beautiful.
In our interview, Morgan explained his musical strategy of channeling everything he felt through his horn. His goal, he said, was to make a direct connection between his heart and a listener's heart. I'd say, mission accomplished.
Author Dean Robbins of Madison brought us that story on saxophonist Frank Morgan. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, an epidemiologist shares steps you can take to protect vulnerable loved ones amid the triple-demic, flu, COVID, RSV, during the holiday season. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Now, even though many people have dropped pandemic precautions, the pandemic is still happening, along with a surge of other potentially severe respiratory illnesses. Hospitalizations for flu-like illnesses, flu, RSV, COVID, and other respiratory viruses are higher than they've been in the last decade, and nearly 2,000 people are still dying from COVID-19 each week here in the U.S. As winter holidays get closer, there are a lot of things we can do to protect people who are at risk for complications and death, including older adults, younger children, people with underlying medical conditions. Caitlin Gentilina is the founder and author of the newsletter Your Local Epidemiologist, Director of Population Health Analytics at Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute. Caitlin, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me again.
Can you give an overview of where we are in the U.S. right now with this combo of multiple respiratory diseases?
Yeah, for actually the first time, the much anticipated and I will say dreaded triple-demic is finally here. RSV, flu, and now COVID-19 are rising together at a national level, and it's not looking very pretty.
And you're concerned in large part this year with people who are vulnerable to illness, these three diseases going around, and we're getting ready to gather for holidays. Who in particular should we be thinking about protecting here?
Yeah, it really depends on the type of virus we're worried about. So, for example, I'm very concerned about those over 65. They are at high risk for RSV, they're at high risk for flu, and they're at high risk for COVID-19. And the main reason for that is because they just have weakened immune systems. The more we grow older, the more weak our immune systems get. So they could be doing everything. They could have their fall COVID-19 booster, they could have the flu shot, and still not be well protected against these viruses, particularly against severe disease. The other group that I'm particularly concerned about are those under five, kids under 5 years old, specifically for RSV. Also, we know flu and COVID-19 is no walk in the park for them either. And so there's a lot of viruses circulating right now, and I think going into the holidays, everyone really needs to plan around their most vulnerable family member.
You, in one of your recent local epidemiologist newsletter, gave a series of steps to take. And starting there and earliest is vaccination, the latest boosters, the flu shot. Could you make the case that if people haven't done those, they ought to do them now?
That's right. I mean, it's truly, I think, one of the lowest hanging fruits. You have to get it and you don't necessarily need to think about it again. You know, if you got your last COVID-19 vaccine a year ago, 2 years ago, it's running out of batteries. It's just without a recent booster, you're not really technically protected. And so that is incredibly important. And I think one of the easier things to do this season. Just keep in mind that time is running out. I mean, if, you know, Christmas is only 3 weeks away. And so it takes a few weeks for that booster to kick in. So I would certainly get it as soon as possible.
And then masking. In general, I think, are masking less than we used to. This would be the time. Could you talk about your masking plans leading up to, say, holiday gatherings?
Yeah, that's right. You know, I just go outside. Very few people are wearing an N95 mask anywhere. But the way I think about it is put on that mask 1 week prior to the event, 1 week prior to Christmas, for example, wear that mask everywhere you go in public, because that will not only help ensure that you don't get sick, so you don't miss the holiday spirits and seeing Santa Claus, et cetera, but that also helps break transmission chains to those vulnerable people. It helps ensure you won't bring the virus to the little kiddos or to grandma or grandpa.
And before we get to the next step, I mean, part of your goal here is that we can gather, that we don't have to cancel those holiday plans, right? That's what we're working toward here.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think we've all sacrificed enough the past 2.5 years. And I think that it's a big quality of life is getting together with family and friends, especially during the holiday season. I just really want to ensure, at least the way I'm thinking about it, is we want to do it in the most safe and most healthy way we can. And we can do that. We have lots of ways to do that.
Talking to epidemiologist Caitlin Jedalina about keeping our gatherings safe from COVID and RSV and flu this holiday season. Okay, testing is also part of your plan. We've got home tests out there. What is the testing regimen you are looking toward?
That's right. So we have testing at least for COVID-19 at home, right? So we don't have flu and RSV tests at home, but we can use them for COVID-19. And the way I kind of see it, as certainly do it if you have symptoms the day or the morning of the event, but also do it even if you're asymptomatic. Do it the morning of the event and a few days before. This is called cadence testing. So testing a few days in a row. And the reason why this is good is because it gives you more likelihood of catching asymptomatic virus. Antigen tests aren't perfect at catching asymptomatic virus, about 44 to 70% of cases it'll catch. But if we do it multiple times, we have higher chances of catching it if we do truly are infected.
And if we test positive just that few days before the event?
Yeah, so unfortunately, it means you're probably going to have to stay home. I mean, I certainly would stay home if you have symptoms, no matter if it's COVID or something else. That is literally the best thing you can do for your family. If you test positive a few days before on a COVID antigen test, I will say that it could be that you're just at the end of your infection. So I would highly suggest testing again that morning of. Just be prepared that you won't be going there. But you may get lucky and it may come out negative and you can go to the holiday celebration.
All right, great news. We're all clean. We're getting together. What are things we can do at the event to help lower the risk of transmission in case something snuck in with somebody?
Ventilation and filtration are really powerful tools. This is especially important in the middle of winter when we head indoors. So get that air moving, get the air conditioning moving. You can have a fan going. If it's nice outside, open those windows. It'll actually do quite a lot. And then again, of course, at the day of the event, if you have symptoms, just stay home. I know this is lonely during the holidays, but it's truly the best thing to do.
And yeah, that's kind of a mindset thing. Everybody's going to be, or many people, I should say, will be bummed to miss a holiday gathering. Can you give us some encouragement to do it if we need to in just our last minute?
I keep saying this, but it's literally the best thing you can do for the vulnerable, those under 5, those over 65, but not only those, it'll help the community as well. Our healthcare systems are incredibly stressed right now. So please stay home, binge watch some Netflix. There's always going to be next Christmas.
Caitlin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you again for having me.
That's Caitlin Jedalina, founder and author of the newsletter Your Local Epidemiologist, director of population health analytics at Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute. She talked to us today about steps we can take to keep at-risk people safe during the upcoming holiday gathering season in the midst of increases in numbers for COVID, flu, and this RSV virus that's out there. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, alcohol accounts for a large share of deaths of working-age Americans, up to 1 in 4 for the age range 20 to 34. That's according to numbers from the CDC. We'll tackle the problem and possible solutions, and you can join in with your questions for our guest, a public health expert, maybe your own experiences. And this will be interesting. It's okay to go out and do things on your own. Our guest says, in fact, we should plan for it. We can make dates for one. So even, you know, even if you have somebody to hang out with, the guest makes the case that it's worth it to take time for yourself, make special plans for yourself, do stuff solo out there, and don't feel weird about, for example, being at that restaurant with a table for one. That and more, all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then it's the season of giving. A philanthropic advisor tells us about how to give back during the winter and beyond. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.